As we approach 22 minutes past the hour, we're joined by Dr. Don Clark. Dr. Don, our resident biochemist, he's a member of the Board of Creation Moments and a vintner in his own right, an occupation that demands all of his biochemistry skills down there in Garden Valley, Texas. Don, happy Tuesday. How you doing?
Oh, doing well. Thank you. Yes, doing quite well.
Okay. Well, that's good. That's good to know. So things in and once again, and we talked about this last week, your vineyard is on sabbatical, a word connected to the word Sabbath. It's a seven-year resting period, right? So your grapes are all just kind of dozing? Is that what's happening?
Oh, the vines?
Yeah.
Well, the vines, you know, you can't stop them from growing.
That's, oh, okay.
Yeah, they're gonna grow, but they're not going to produce fruit this year. Mm-hmm. We have trimmed them back and regrowing the cordons and having this year for the vines to kind of rest and to get more.
So literally, you prevented them from growing grapes by your trimming.
Pretty much. I mean, yeah, they will, you know, shoot. They did shoot the little grape buds, but we're cutting those off, and we're allowing the vines just to absorb energy and get stronger, and
they'll produce
more fruit in the years to come.
All right, that's very promising.
Is that a normal thing to do, Don? I mean, do other grape do the same thing?
No one that I know does this.
Really? Interesting. Okay.
Well, but it's biblical.
At least by choice.
Yeah, it's biblical. That's the way it's supposed to happen. And just imagine if all over the world that we performed in cycles like is recommended, agriculturally speaking, in the Bible. I think it would make a huge difference.
Well, it certainly would, because we're asked to lay Leviticus 25 is where, you know, where I'm getting this from, and it speaks about the vine specifically, but it also speaks about laying the fields fallow for a year,
mm-hmm.
At the seventh growing year to build nutrients back into the soil. Well, we've taken the approach that, oh, we can just add artificial fertilizers to the soil and everything will be okay. And we just can't add all of the nutrients that the soil needs just by adding artificial fertilizers. And so, it's there was a reason, obviously, for God to tell the Israelites to do that. One was to teach them the seven-year period cycle, but also it, kind of gave them a year to concentrate more on him as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're not the fields working, mm-hmm. I mean, not that we're not working in the vineyard, because we are, but you can then spend the time thanking God for all the blessings that he's given you in the past 6 years.
And then what happens after seven-year sabbatical cycles? You have a jubilee year, don't you?
You have a jubilee, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, imagine what that would do to the economy if all debts were canceled, all property goes back to the original owners, 50 years ago, and you start over.
Yep.
That sounds wacko in this day and age, doesn't it?
Well, it sounds wacky, but, if you look at the economy, economics about it, we're forced into that cycle whether we want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that, if you've sold your property, people give it back to you, but the economy kind of goes through a 50-year cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And so either you're going to obey God's commandments or you suffer the consequences and see, oh, gee, we're having a great recession. And, we can have those, quite regularly, I believe that we would see more prosperity if we obeyed, obviously, God's principles and God's laws.
Well, there's something about cycles in nature, and I read a book once. It was written by a geologist, and his premise was that the Earth is due for another realigning of the poles, and it would be like a 15-degree shift in the axis. He says ice accumulates, the Earth starts to wobble, and then it naturally corrects itself by shifting in one direction or another. And, of course, that creates tsunamis and earthquakes and volcanoes and all kinds of things. And he says the cycle that has happened in geologic time, that's the term he used, geologic time, about every 10,000 years, which is very brief in geologic terms, because geologists know that things take thousands and thousands and sometimes millions of years to occur. So the things that we observe are just naturally very, very old. But apparently, Don, there's some recent studies that maybe ought to have secular scientists rethinking that position, huh?
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. You know, we we go through, and whenever you take a trip, you're looking at geology. And so, especially if you head kind of out west in the Midwest, and you get to South Dakota and North Dakota, and you see all the badlands, and you're saying to yourself, well, you should say to yourself at least, hey, where did these, how did all these deposits get here? And why is the Earth so striated? That is, why are there so many layers? And how did those get laid down? Well, you know, traditional geology would say, well, it did take millions and millions of years, you know, to lay down those different layers. And they didn't happen overnight. Well, you know, we look at those layers, those different mud layers, for example. They were mud at one time, and the different sedimentary layers. We now have vast evidence that interpretation is wrong.
Well, we're talking about sedimentary rock, correct? Now, not like igneous rock, because there are new layers of rock all over Hawaii these days, and some new ones forming down in Guatemala as well. That happens pretty quick. And some things we saw around Mount St. Helens when it erupted back in, 1981 or so, have opened some eyes about the difference between supposed geologic time and the reality of how the Earth works. But sedimentary rocks have always been assumed that, you know, all little particles float in still water, and they drop to the bottom.
They settle down.
And then they keep building up layers on the bottom of still water, and that's why it takes so long. But I guess now there's pretty hard evidence, so to speak. We're talking rocks here. I guess that's a pun, isn't it? Hard evidence to the contrary.
Yes, indeed. That these sediments, I mean, it's been known for a while, for example, clay and slate, for example, had to be formed by quick moving water. That it just didn't striate out like that by settling to the bottom. And if you think about it, you know, rocks are going to settle out, or particles are going to settle out, depending on their, you know, their density and the certain flow of the water that they happen to be in at the time. And the Mount St. Helens experiment, if you will, or the demonstration, that when you have a lot of water, that was up at the top of the volcano, and that melts rapidly because of the volcanic activity and slides down the mountain, it formed a great deal of sedimentary rock all at one time. I mean, it was mud, obviously, at the time. Mm-hmm. But then when subsequent flows, whether it be mud flows or water flows, happened through that sedimentary layer, what you had was a canyon that was over 100 feet deep. And that didn't take, you know, millions of years. That took all of one day to create. So we have little microcosms of examples, for example, like of that type of thing happening. But the geologists seem not to want to look at that too closely. But there's been a relatively recent study that shows that, hey, we thought that, you know, limestone or lime mud, if you will, carbonate mud was deposited slowly in this, you know, in the oceans, and it just kind of settled out. But recent study has shown that, hey, you get if you have water, if you have, you know, this mineral in your water and these particles in your water, and the water is flowing between 10 to 20 inches per second, then the deposit that you get that is formed looks exactly like what we see in the environment with these type of things. Now, this sedimentary layer is between, you know, in the Grand Canyon, for example, is between 400 and 800 feet thick. But there's other parts of the Earth, especially closer to the ocean, where it is 3,000 feet thick. And it's hard to imagine how one could form a sedimentary layer that, you know, is caused by rapid water movement without the explanation of the flood, especially that thick. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can understand that, okay, now we have an example with Mount St. Helens that we can have a layer 100, 120 feet thick. But this is a pure lime mud carbonate layer that is that thick with the ripples through it that, you know, we see if you go into limestone caves, for example. You see these ripples as you're walking through, you know, through the cave. And, you know, you should wonder to yourself, well, how is that formed? I mean, it you know, and it certainly wasn't formed over millions
well,
of years.
Well, wasn't the theory that, and this is just plain old logic, I suppose, that sediment at the bottom of a mass of water is subject to huge pressure, downward pressure. Gravity pulls that water down, the weight of the water compressing all that into stone. But this suggests that horizontal movement of water over a layer of sediment provides even more pressure.
Well, it's not necessarily the pressure so much as it is the gradation of the particles that are settling out. Mm. And it's the water movement that is creating that, and not necessarily the depth of the water.
So because of the movement of the water, the particles would tend that settle out would tend to be of similar size, I guess, which would make it more uniform. I got you. Okay.
Right. And then, of course, if the water went away, then, you know, it would dry up, and the particles would solidify into sandstone or you know, in this case, limestone. That we see today. So you had the flood model, the flood which is described in Genesis, describes this quite well, because it says that obviously the waters covered the hills, the high hills at that time of all of the earth. All of the earth was covered. And the process seems to have been, not only did we have the continents breaking apart probably at that time, or right at that time, and subsequent to that time, and the continents drifting, you know, drifting apart, but you had tremendous volcanic activity. You had all of this movement, you know, going on the surface of the earth.
Including massive climate changes as well.
Massive climate changes, microbe changes happening, because if you had a series of volcanoes going off, that would block the sun, so the earth would cool down. The waters would still be warm, because before the flood it was a more temperate climate, for example. So you have all of this water being pumped up into the atmosphere, and then when the earth is shielded, when the land is shielded, let me distinguish between the oceans and the land, when the land is shielded, then the land would be very cold because of, lack of sunlight. And so the early stages of the, post-flood period, it was a tremendous period of rapid catastrophes happening all over the earth, and instead of, you know, just a little wave coming up on the surface of the land, we're talking about tremendous tsunamis on the order of perhaps, you know, as high as 800 feet, which, of course, we don't see today because we don't have the movement that we've had, you know, in the past. And so a lot of the evidence, or I shouldn't say a lot, all of the evidence that we see in geology of these sediment layers and, you know, even the ice age that happened. You know, folks say, well, you know, the ice age went through several cycles. Every 10 million years, we have another mini ice age. Well, that's, if you're interpreting it from a long, you know, time frame point of view, then okay, yeah, maybe it happened over 10,000 years, 10 million years, because we can count the layers in the ice and say, oh, see how many layers we've got? That's each layer represents a year. There's no evidence of that. And in fact, if each of the layers in the in the ice from ice core samples, if those are periods of greater volcanic activity, for example, and the volcanic dust settling out of this of the snow that is depositing at the same time, then you've got a different interpretation altogether. You've got an interpretation of, gee, at some point in our recent past, we had a lot of volcanic activity in various cycles that have created these deposits, and then you've got a different interpretation. That's the same thing with these sediment layers, for example. If you interpret them and do empirical experiments where, and you could do this in the lab, you can mix up your mud and then, you know, set your flow rate at various rates and see what settles out and what it looks like. That's exactly what these researchers did with this lime mud, for example, this carbonate mud, and they found that their results, the resultant layers that were laid down, looked exactly what you find in nature if your flow rate is, you know, between the 10 to 20 inches per second in their experiments.
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a period of multiple climate and geological catastrophes, hence the term catastrophism, to describe this, which is contrary to the old, what word are we replacing here with catastrophism? What there must be some word they used for uniformitarianism?
Uniformitarianism, yeah. Everything happens over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. What we see today is what the conditions have always been, and so, this is, of course, the explanation for the Grand Canyon, that, oh, Grand Canyon was carved by the Colorado River over, you know, millions of years. Well, we know that is not true. Mm-hmm. It was carved very quickly, and maybe not through one, you know, water flow, for example, going through this light sediment material, but multiple water flows that we can see, and exposing more and more of the lower, lighter, you know, sedimentary layers that we can now see in this mile-wide canyon that we call the Grand Canyon.
Now, we've talked several times about other ramifications of this, of these water flows over time, and just to reiterate some of that, you believe that the chain of geologic and climatological events that were generated by the flood probably took 700-800 years to run the course, huh?
Yes, that's what it seems like it probably did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, between 500 to 700 years, which would have given, by the way, more than enough time for the population, for the Earth's human population to repopulate.
Mm-hmm.
From 8 people as described, you know, in the biblical account, that eight people survived this catastrophe, and for them to multiply to such great a number, and actually start accumulating in, you know, in one valley in the Middle East, that, you know, they had to be dispersed because mm-hmm. God said, you know, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. That commandment didn't change after the flood, and he it actually had more of an emphasis after the flood than before the flood.
And there is research in another branch of science, biology, that has to do with DNA research that tends to verify what you just said.
Yes, as well as where the different people groups, you know, mm-hmm. after Babel, for example, mm-hmm. the Tower of Babel in the Shinar Valley, and hence we get the area known as Babylon, you know, today, where the people actually dispersed to. And, of course, you know, there was, you had, and it's interesting, you know, because you had three main families. You had Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And, of course, you know, Shem was later the tribe that formed Israel, and Japheth, that group of people seemed to have tended to go north in populated Europe, for example, and then Ham went to Africa and over to the lower parts of Asia and populated, you know, that part of the world. So yeah, the DNA analysis supports that the tribal migrations quite nicely,
and more geology factoring in too in patterns of dinosaur bone deposits or fossil deposits indicate vast water flows that drove herds of animals hither and yon to where we find them today. That's another we had to repeat that program sometime because that was another fascinating discussion. On the outcomes, the ramifications of the Great Flood and those water flows we've been talking about today. Interesting stuff. It really is. Always interesting with you, Doug. Don, we've got to get you to change your name here, I think.
I guess so, yes.
Yeah. Don Clark, a member of the Board of Creation Moments. I want to recommend their website to you. It's creationmoments.com. And on the website, you'll find just a valuable treasure trove of scientific information that supports the biblical story of creation. And it'll make sense to you. You give it a chance, open your eyes, and rethink some old positions. You'll see what an amazing picture develops and how Genesis, while not a scientific document, is an historic document with information that pertains. Don, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
And, you're quite welcome, and you folks have a great week.
We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks,
Don. Wait a second. No, next Tuesday, there'll be no morning show next week.
No morning show.
I'll be in transit, so it'll be a couple, maybe 3 weeks before we get together again. But I'll keep you posted. And
okay,
again,
sounds good. Thank
you for what you brought us today. It was pretty special. We'll see ya. Bye-bye.
All righty. So long.